Hello, and welcome to the Fighting Moose Podcast. I'm your host and narrator, Jason Hendrickson. This is a podcast where I retell stories, some fictional and some historical, that can be enjoyed by people of all ages. If you are like me, you don't really tend to reread books, and then every once in a while, you need to purge the bookshelf. Well, this purge happened a few days ago at our house. Between John and I, we ended up getting rid of a whole box of books. Now don't worry, these end up at the local Goodwill so other people can enjoy them, and that is usually where we find all of our books anyway. At our local Goodwill, the paperbacks are usually on sale, 4 books for $1. I mean, you can't beat that price. Anyway, one of the books that was getting donated was Mutiny on Board the HMS Bounty. Looking through that box, John asked me if this story was available for the podcast, so I said I would check if I could find it, and sure enough, I did. Reading the foreword of today's book, I couldn't tell if this is supposed to be an abridged version or not, but from my recollection of reading the book, it really just gets down to the meat and potatoes of the story. So today, we read the story, Narrative of the Mutiny of the Bounty, from the book Great Sea Stories, edited by Joseph Louis French. Now, let's turn to today's story. I hope you enjoy. Let's begin.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Narrative of the Mutiny of the Bounty. About the year 1786, the merchants and planters interested in the West India Islands became anxious to introduce an exceedingly valuable plant, the breadfruit tree, into these possessions, and as this could best be done by a government expedition, a request was preferred to the crown accordingly. The ministry at the time being favorable to the proposed undertaking, a vessel named the Bounty was selected to execute the desired object. To the command of this ship, Captain W. Bligh was appointed August 16, 1787. The burden of the Bounty was nearly 215 tons. The establishment of men and officers for the ship was as follows: 1 lieutenant to command, 1 master, 1 boatswain, 1 gunner, 1 carpenter, 1 surgeon, 2 master's mates, 2 midshipmen, 2 quartermasters, 1 quartermaster's mate, 1 boatswain's mate, 1 gunner's mate, 1 carpenter's mate, 1 carpenter's crew, 1 sailmaker, 1 armorer, 1 corporal, 1 clerk and steward, 23 able seamen, total 44. The addition of 2 men appointed to take care of the plants made the whole ship's crew amount to 46. The ship was stored and victualled for 18 months. Thus prepared, the Bounty set sail on the 23rd of December, and what ensued will be best told in the language of Captain Bligh. Monday, 27th, April 1789. The wind being northerly in the evening, we steered to the westward to pass to the south of Tofoa. I gave directions for this course to be continued during the night. The master had the first watch, the gunner the middle watch, and Mr. Christian the morning watch. Tuesday, 25th. Just before sunrising, while I was yet asleep, Mr. Christian, with the master-at-arms, gunner's mate, and Thomas Burkitt, seaman, came into my cabin and, seizing me, tied my hands with a cord behind my back, threatening me with instant death if I spoke or made the least noise. I, however, called as loud as I could in hopes of assistance, but they had already secured the officers who were not of their party by placing sentinels at their doors. There were three men at my cabin door, besides the four within. Christian had only a cutlass in his hand, the others had muskets and bayonets. I was pulled out of bed and forced on deck in my shirt, suffering great pain from the tightness with which they had tied my hands. I demanded the reason of such violence, but received no other answer than abuse for not holding my tongue. The master, the gunner, the surgeon, Mr. Elphinstone, master's mate, and Nelson were kept confined below, and the fore hatchway was guarded by sentinels. The boatswain and carpenter, and also the clerk, Mr. Samuel, were allowed to come upon deck. The boatswain was ordered to hoist the launch out, with a threat, if he did not do it instantly, to take care of himself. When the boat was out, Mr. Hayward and Mr. Hallett, two of the midshipmen, and Mr. Samuel were ordered into it. I demanded what their intention was in giving this order, and endeavored to persuade the people near me not to persist in such acts of violence, but it was to no effect. Christian changed the cutlass which he had in his hand for a bayonet that was brought to him, and holding me with a strong grip by the cord that tied my hands, he, with many oaths, threatened to kill me immediately if I would not be quiet. The villains round me had their pieces cocked and bayonets fixed. Particular people were called on to go into the boat and were hurried over the side, whence I concluded that with these people I was to be set adrift. I therefore made another effort to bring about a change, but with no other effect than to be threatened with having my brains blown out. The boatswain and seamen who were to go in the boat were allowed to collect twine, canvas, lines, sails, cordage, an 8-and-20-gallon cask of water, and Mr. Samuel got 150 pounds of bread with a small quantity of rum and wine, also a quadrant and compass, but he was forbidden, on pain of death, to touch either map, ephemeris, book of astronomical observations, sextant, timekeeper, or any of my surveys or drawings. The officers were next called upon deck and forced over the side into the boat, while I was kept apart from everyone abaft the mizzen mast. Isaac Martin, one of the guard over me, I saw had an inclination to assist me, and as he fed me with shaddock, my lips being quite parched, we explained our wishes to each other by our looks. But this being observed, Martin was removed from me. He then attempted to leave the ship, for which purpose he got into the boat, but with many threats they obliged him to return. The armorer, Joseph Coleman, and two of the carpenters, Mintosh and Norman, were also kept contrary to their inclination, and they begged of me, after I was astern in the boat, to remember that they declared that they had no hand in the transaction. Michael Byrne, I am told, likewise wanted to leave the ship. It appeared to me that Christian was some time in doubt whether he should keep the carpenter or his mates. At length he determined on the latter, and the carpenter was ordered into the boat. He was permitted, but not without some opposition, to take his tool chest. The officers and men being in the boat, they only waited for me, of which the master-at-arms informed Christian, who then said, "Come, Captain Bligh, your officers and men are now in the boat, and you must go with them. If you attempt to make the least resistance, you will instantly be put to death." And without further ceremony, with a tribe of armed ruffians about me, I was forced over the side, where they untied my hands. Being in the boat, we were veered astern by a rope. A few pieces of pork were thrown to us, and some clothes, also four cutlasses, and it was then that the armorer and carpenters called out to me to remember that they had no hand in the transaction. After having undergone a great deal of ridicule and having been kept some time to make sport for these unfeeling wretches, we were at length cast adrift in the open ocean. I had 18 persons with me in the boat. There remained on board the Bounty 25 hands, the most able men of the ship's company. Having little or no wind, we rowed pretty fast towards Tofoa, which bore northeast about 10 leagues from us. While the ship was in sight, she steered to the west-northwest, but I considered this only as a feint, for when we were sent away, "Huzzah for Otaheite!" was frequently heard among the mutineers. It will very naturally be asked, what could be the reason for such a revolt? In answer to which, I can only conjecture that the mutineers had flattered themselves with the hopes of a more happy life among the Otaheitans than they could possibly enjoy in England, and thus joined to some female connections most probably occasioned the whole transaction. The women at Otaheite are handsome, mild, and cheerful in their manners and conversation, possessed of great sensibility, and have sufficient delicacy to make them admired and beloved. The chiefs were so much attached to our people that they rather encouraged their stay among them than otherwise, and even made them promises of large possessions. Under these and many other attendant circumstances equally desirable, it is now perhaps not so much to be wondered at, though scarcely possible to have been foreseen, that a set of sailors, most of them void of connections, should be led away, especially when, in addition to such powerful inducements, they imagined it in their power to fix themselves in the midst of plenty, on one of the finest islands in the world, where they need not labor, and where the allurements of dissipation are beyond anything that can be conceived.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fighting Moose Podcast. Please join us next time as we read another exciting story. Today's music was provided by the artist Analog by Nature, and the audio clips were provided from NASA. For more information to download and or listen to audio or materials from all our recordings, or to contact us, please visit www.thefightingmoose.com, or you can follow the links in the show notes. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcast or on iTunes and tell a friend. Thank you for your patronage, and as always, try and do a random act of kindness every day.
Mission complete, Houston. After serving the world for over 30 years, the Space Shuttle has earned its place in history and has come to a final stop.